As Michael mentioned in announcements, we will plan for a forum this evening over the morning topic. So you may want to take notes or write down questions or comments that you may want to share in the evening after the songs and the prayers and the Lord's Supper. We'll open the floor for any comments about the subject that we're studying this morning. If you wish to email me this afternoon with your questions or comments, you can do that as well. We know that it is God's plan that churches have overseers, qualified overseers. When Paul and Barnabas went back through the churches on their first preaching journey, in Acts chapter 14, verse 23, it says they appointed elders for them in every church. One of those men was an apostle, and one of those men was a prophet. And this was God's plan that those churches, though those churches were relatively new in the faith, might have qualified overseers or elders or bishops. When Titus was on the island of Crete, Paul wrote this young preacher a letter and encouraged him to appoint elders in every church, Titus chapter 1 and verse 5. What that meant was he was to do the kind of teaching that would encourage brethren and prepare brethren to select the right men to serve in that capacity. Over the past few weeks, we have studied a couple lessons about the qualifications of the men who can serve in that capacity. And it may well be in the weeks coming we'll have some additional lessons along that line. However, there is one qualification that always seems to be one that people focus on. And sometimes, of all the qualifications, it's one that men are felt not to meet. And so we want to look at that qualification. We do not want to lay down rules or standards that God has not laid down, and at the same time, we want to respect the rule or the standard that God has put in force. So our effort is to try to understand what has been revealed. There are two passages that we'll be looking at. The first one's in 1 Timothy 3, and the second one's in Titus chapter 1. If you'll open your Bible, if you can put a marker at one of the passages, or maybe both of the passages, we'll be able to look at those two passages in the course of our study. I want to begin by simply reading them, 1 Timothy chapter 3. You know that he's talking about the qualifications of men who can serve in that capacity, all the way from verse 1. We're dropping down to verse 4. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And then over in Titus chapter 1 and in verse 6, again, talking to Titus about the men who are qualified to serve in that capacity, he said, if any man is above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, this version says, this is the New American Standard Version, some versions say having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. Our study will revolve around three questions that often arise relative to these qualifications about an elder's and elder's family, particularly his children. Must he have more than one child? It says having faithful children. Would a man that only has one child qualify? The second question is, must his children be Christians? In the passage in Titus 1, as it's translated in the New American Standard Version as well as others, it points to the fact that the children are Christians. So must the children be Christians? And then the third question, must those children continue to be faithful Christians? What happens if some years later one or more of those children no longer demonstrate the fact that they're Christians, or if it's not talking about being Christians, if it's talking about being faithful to the Father, what if later they fail in that regard? Furthermore, must the children be living? What if the children pass away? What if the children no longer live because they were, for example, in a car accident or suffered an untimely death through illness? Does the man qualify? Can it be said he is having faithful children? So, in the course of our study this morning, we'll be looking at some of these questions that arise on these qualifications. I want to remind our audience this morning of something we have touched on in some previous lessons, but I think it's very critical to our study, and that is the fact that in both places, 1 Timothy and in Titus, that the Holy Spirit guided the pen of the apostle to use words that indicate character. Note in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, an overseer then must be. To be verbs are followed either by words that rename the subject or describe the subject. I'm convinced that these terms that follow describe the man. They are something about the man's character. In Titus chapter 1, the term he uses is, if any man is, that's the New American Standard, but that's the 95 edition. We have encouraged you, if you have been in the audiences in the past, in your Bible study, to compare versions. That could be very valuable, particularly in a study like this one. It's interesting when you look at the New American Standard pre-95 edition. It's sometimes called the 77 edition. It has the word be, like the King James does. And some other versions. But what you see in both of these is you have that word that points to character qualification. If that's correct, whether you're talking about husband of one wife, which we talked about in a previous lesson, referring to the fact that he's a one-woman man, not whether he's currently married, but whether he's a one-woman man character, or whether you're looking at temperate or prudent or respectable or these other things in the list, when you get down to the verse 4 and 5 of 1 Timothy 3, about his children or having faithful children in Titus 1, it's still looking at what kind of man he is. The only reason for looking at the children is because they say something about the man. We're not interested in the children. I don't mean by that we don't care about them. That's not our focus. The only reason for looking at the children is because of what they say about him. And since he says he must be, he must continue to be. That's a present tense. The idea is, whether it's 5 years later or 10 years later, he still must be that kind of man. And so if you take Titus 1, he still must be having faithful children. He must continue as long as he serves in that capacity. All right. So the first question is about the plurality of children. It's pointed out, and it correctly so, that the word that is used is a plural word. That is not debatable. That's a fact. The word children refers to more than one, the word itself. What we must be aware of, however, is that a plural word sometimes can be indefinite as to number. Now we have examples in our own language. If you go somewhere, you have to fill out a form to qualify for whatever it may be. On that form, it may have a question, number of children, question mark. If you have one, do you leave it blank? Or do you put one? The question has a plural word, number of children, but you know that while the plural is meant, it's literal, it means one or more. Our language recognizes that. Again, if you are trying to get insurance for your car, there may be a question. Drivers under 25, question mark. What if you only have one driver under 25? How do you answer that question? You would say, yes, because you understand that what is meant by the plural drivers is one or more. It's indefinite as to number. If you go to some place, used to be in hospitals, that children under a certain age, children, say, under 12, must be accompanied by parents. Sometimes you'll see that in these warehouses where they got food samples. Children under 12 must be accompanied by parents. What if you only have one? Is it okay then if no parents accompany the child? You know that that's not the case. So we are used to this concept. Now, does that prove that the word children in Titus 1 is indefinite, that it can mean one or more? Listen carefully. I am not saying that proves that that's the way the word is used there. What I am saying is that in our language, and the Bible is written in the language in which humans speak, plurals sometimes are used indefinitely to refer to one or more. All right, what about the New Testament? Now let's look at three passages. The first one is Matthew chapter 22 and verse 24. Matthew chapter 22, verse 24. People ask Jesus a question. Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children. One mark I want to make, hopefully you'll remember this, is that phrase, having children, is just like the one in Titus 1:6. The only difference is the negative. No. Having no children. Having children. Same kind of phrase as in Titus 1:6. We'll have occasion to refer to that again later. But note he says, if a man dies having no children, his brother, as next of kin, shall marry his wife and raise up children for his brother. What if he had one child? Would his brother have to marry his wife? The answer is no. Clearly, the meaning of this biblical passage is using a plural word, children, indefinitely, one or more. You can confirm that, if you needed confirmation, by looking at Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 5, where that's the passage this refers to, and it says if he dies and has no son, singular. So it seems to me beyond doubt that this text, having children, is using the word in an indefinite sense to include one or more. The second passage is Mark chapter 10, verse 29. Peter began to say to him, behold, we have left everything and followed you. Jesus said, truly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or farms for my sake and for the gospel's sake, but that he'll receive 100 times as much now in the present age and in the age to come eternal life. Now when he said, there's no man that has left children, it's the plural word. What if he only had one child and left that child in his priority for serving Christ? Would he qualify in this text? You know that he would. While the plural word is used, it was used indefinitely to refer to one or more. The third passage is 1 Timothy chapter 5, 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 4. If a widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. Could a widowed woman, could her son argue, well, this is plural, and she only has one child, so this does not include me? You'd know that would be incorrect, and he would be skirting his duty. You know that while the plural word is used, if a widow has children, it includes that one son or however many she may have. It's indefinite. So those passages show that the word children in the plural was used by the Holy Spirit in certain passages to mean one or more. Does that prove that's the way it's used in Titus 1? No. That is not what I am arguing. What it shows is that it is a possibility. A possibility we must consider. How do we decide how it's used in Titus 1:6? We use our two tools of Bible study, context and harmony, to reach a conclusion whether or not that word is used that way in that text. Please, let's avoid deciding that question on the basis of, I think, purely something subjective, or tradition, or my parents, or my preacher said. None of that proves how it's used in those texts. We must have something concrete in the context or in harmony if we're going to be certain about what it means. So we're looking at this idea of children, more than one. We've already looked at the concept that the word children is a plural word but can be used in an indefinite sense. Now let's continue to add to our study. When he says, having faithful children in Titus 1:6, a question comes to my mind. This is a character qualification or a qualification of elders. Is it a measure of his ability to procreate, or is it a measure of his ability to rule? Which one of the two fits the context? Whether he is capable of having more than one child, or whether he is able and demonstrating his ability to rule whatever children that may be under his jurisdiction and control. Now turn to 1 Timothy 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1, and we're going to look at the parallel passage. We talked about the law of harmony. So here we have Titus 1, having faithful children, both letters by the same author, both letters discussing the same subject, the qualifications of elders. Now over here in 1 Timothy 3, you do not have that term, having faithful children. But in the parallel qualifications, you have this. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. If a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Now, you do have the term children, but in this text, is it not clear that he's not talking about how many he has, but how he rules the ones, one or more, that he has? Which is in view in the text when he talks about how to manage his household, having them in control with all dignity. Is it number, or is it something about the children that tells you something about the man's character? Now, let me stop for just a moment, and we're going to deal with other questions that might arise in our forum tonight, but I want to deal with this one right now. One may argue that the reason I believe, someone may say, that it must be more than one is because children are different. And therefore, he must have more than one to have had the experience needed to rule a congregation. Please be aware that that conclusion rests upon, I think, not anything in the text. Let's take that out a little further. Since this is in the realm of human conjecture, how many children must he have? I have three. They're all different. So if the fact that children are different is why you must have more than one, if he rules a congregation of 100 people, must he have 100 children? And then, number 101 may be different from the others. So we've got to be careful about reasoning from, I think, human conjecture. Furthermore, let me ask you this. If you're reasoning, say, well, I think more than one is necessary for him to have that experience, what if he has three girls and no boys? Or three boys and no girls? Now, is he qualified to rule a congregation with both males and females? So, I agree that his ability to rule is what is under consideration. But concluding that the plurality is required because there's a difference in children is a subjective conclusion, not an objective conclusion based on anything in the text. Okay? Now, what about this term faithful? Having faithful children. Again, I want to mention something we've already mentioned, and that is the value of comparing translations. When you study your Bible, compare particularly the major translations, the King James, New King James, the American Standard of 1901, the New American Standard, and there's two different versions of that one that sometimes differ, and it's helpful. So these are helpful in comparing. So here it says in this version, having children who believe. The English Standard Version translates, and that's one of the most modern versions that many brethren are now using, and it says, who are believers. This is not a verb. They've translated it that way, but it is not. Faithful is an adjective modifying children. So just be aware of that when you compare versions. Where did they get this translation? It's always good to compare against like the New King James and the American Standard, particularly of 1901. So, the word that's translated, believers are faithful, is this word that I have on the chart, P-I-S-T-O-S. It's an adjective. Now, the King James Version says faithful children. The New American Standard Version says believing children. It can be translated either way. So it's not a question of translation we're looking at here. You have two alternatives. If you're interested in that, you can pursue that. I've got those who know the grammar who state that very clearly, know the original language. The very fact that these versions with these panel of scholars translated different certainly points you to that. And so, is he talking about a person who, a child who is believing the gospel of Jesus Christ, or we say a Christian? Or is he talking about a child who is trustworthy? Faithful can mean trustworthy. Not doing the believing, but someone, a child that someone can believe in, have confidence in. And that's what we're looking at. Now, which of the two, if we're looking at character qualifications, which best says something about the character of the father? A child who has come to believe the gospel, or a child that conducts himself in such a way that the father has confidence in that child, that he is respectful and obedient? Now, holding your finger here, go back to 1 Timothy chapter 3. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, in the parallel passage, in verse 4, note, it's the idea of his ability to rule with dignity or honor. It's not a matter of just issuing edicts and enforcing them by threats, but rather he manages his household well, keeping his children in control with all dignity. It's a well-ordered household. Why? So that it will be demonstrated that he can take care of the church of God. Verse 1, he's called an overseer. Verse 5, it says his job is to take care of the church of God. The aim and goal is verse 15, so that the church of God will be a pillar and ground of the truth. That is, the truth will be taught and the truth will be lived in the life of its members. You can read 1 Timothy and see that that thread runs through that letter. And so is he a man that can rule in such a way as to encourage people to believe and know and live by the truth? That's the idea. So which of these two better fits? The idea of causing people to initially obey the gospel, or causing people to live an ordered life that people can respect? Certainly that's true as you look at his children. Now, when you look at John chapter 5 and verse 40, you say, well, you know, he's going to have to rule the church, and the church is composed of Christians, and so it looks like it would be talking about his ability to convert people, maybe. Well, in John 5:40, Jesus is the master teacher, and he says, you are unwilling to come to me so that you may have life. I have a question. If Jesus taught for 3 years and he could not convince people to obey the gospel, was it a failure in his teaching? What is his inability or lack of knowledge? You would say no. Obeying the gospel is a matter of free moral agency. A man can be the absolute best teacher. It does not mean that people are going to obey the gospel. Look again at 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and in verse 6. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So Paul said, whether people respond to my teaching there in Corinth, the teaching I did when I went there, is in God's department, not mine. I want you to look at this contrast that we have in the text. So we've looked at the law of harmony. We've compared other passages about one's... Does it say anything about the teacher if people fail to respond to his teaching? And the answer is not necessarily, does it? Could be, but not necessarily. We've looked at the parallel passage in 1 Timothy that seems to look at the man's ability to rule rather than his ability to teach the gospel. And now we look at the comparison in the context in Titus chapter 1. If you are sitting at the table and you'll say, I'll have steak, not tea. That seemed like an unnatural contrast. Would it not be a more natural contrast to say, I'll have steak, not ham? In other words, two different kinds of meat. Or, I'll have coffee, not tea. Now you got two different kinds of drink. That's a more natural contrast, one that you would expect. All right, so here you have in the text children who are believers, are faithful children. Let's insert the word Christians. Children who are Christians, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. A natural contrast would be having children who are Christians, not infidels. That would just be a natural contrast. But that's not what he said. He said not accused of dissipation or rebellion. Now, here's another contrast. Having children who are trustworthy, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. That seems to be the more natural contrast between two items. And further leads me to believe that what he's talking about is not children believing the gospel or being Christians, but children whose conduct, even when they're out of the immediate range of the Father's sight or hearing, they are trustworthy because he rules in such a way that those children have respect for him. In the 14th chapter of the book of Acts is an interesting text along the line of our study. Remember, we're continuing to look at what these qualifications say about the character of the Father, and you must make your decisions on that basis. In the 14th chapter, we have chapters 13 and 14 that describe what we call the first preaching journey. The whole period of time from 13 to 15 is not over 5 years. The preaching journey was less, maybe 3 to 4 years. And what's interesting about that is you have him going into these cities, preaching the gospel, people are converted, churches begin. On his return on that same journey, in verse 21, we read, after he had preached the gospel to that city and had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra, to Iconium, and to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples. Go to verse 23. And when they had appointed elders for them in every church. Here's the question. Unless the qualification changed from the time of Acts 14 to Titus chapter 1, there's a time span in years between those two. I have no indication that the qualifications were any different in Acts 14 than they were in Titus 1. So if it's referring to the same thing, they appointed elders in each one of these churches. What you would have to conclude, you would be forced to conclude, if Titus 1 means having children who are Christians, that every one of these elders in every one of these churches was able to convert all his children in that short span of time. And even if you don't say it's all the children, he'd have to convert enough of them to say he had believing children. That's possible, but it seems to me to be improbable. However, if what he's talking about is not that the children are Christians, but that he has ruled in such a way that these children are obedient and respectful, they respect the rule of his father, as a Jewish man growing up, or maybe even a godly Gentile man like Cornelius, he may have demonstrated to those who know him that he is that kind of man. He may not have taught them the truth about Christ because he didn't know it, but he could have taught them respect for authority, he could have taught them about obedience, he could have taught them about trust, he could have taught them about truth. And people who know the man and his family say, yeah, that's a man, a having faithful children kind of man. He's that kind of a ruler in his family. That seems to me, make your own decision, to better fit the context of Acts chapter 14. Another question arises in this, and that is this term having faithful children. So, let's suppose that he had children who were faithful, whether you think it's talking about Christians or children who were obedient to the Father. But now 10 years has passed or 15 years has passed, and those children have now grown up and either renounced the faith they had or become rebellious now, just living a life of dissolution. Now the question is he still having faithful children? That question is a valid question. What if all of his children have died? Maybe they were going somewhere together and all of them got killed in a car wreck. You know that happens. And so here he had a great family. Either they were all Christians or they were all faithful, trustworthy, whichever you take it. But now they're all dead. So here's this guy. If he's serving as an elder, must he resign? If he's not an elder and his name is put before the congregation, is he a legitimate candidate to be selected by the congregation? Much hinges on how we take this having faithful children. We're not trying to make grammar students of anyone. In fact, every time I look at grammar, I've got to go back and study my notes again and try to be sure I understand what I'm talking about. But hopefully what we are talking about here, we can demonstrate with some passages that will make what we're talking about clear. Having is a present participle, and what it's talking about is something that is currently going on. They use present to talk not about time, but kind of action. This is currently true. He's having faithful children. Here's the question. Is it talking about the man doing something, having faithful children, or is it talking about something the man has done, some action that identifies the man, that tells you something about the man? He said, I never heard anything like that before. Oh, yes, you have. Yes, you have. Look at John chapter 6. John chapter 6 and verse 33. The bread of God is that which comes. Did you note the S on the end of the word? He did not say came, C-A-M-E. He said comes. Here again, there's a value in comparing versions. If you read the King James or the American Standard, it says come eth, E-T-H. Those translations were good. They were trying to tell the reader something. And what they were telling the reader is it's this kind of verb that we're talking about. And so here when you look at John 6, the bread which cometh or comes. One version, in fact, Young's literal translation, some of you are familiar with that version. It says, are you the bread which is coming down? Coming, I-N-G. It reflects the present participle. Well, he's not coming down out of heaven. He's been down in heaven from heaven for over 30 years. It's not an action that's going on right then, but he's identified in connection with that action. He's a coming down out of heaven kind of man. And that's his whole point here. He said, I didn't come from here. I don't have earthly origin. You read the sermon, you see that's what he's talking about. You have the same thing in verse 50. This is the bread which comes, S, or cometh, is coming down out of heaven. We read that over, we don't even stop to think about it because in our minds we make that transition. We know he's not coming right then, but he's identified with that action. So while you say, I've never heard of that, yeah, you have, you just don't go through this process. Look at Mark chapter 6 and verse 14. When Herod heard it, for his name had become well known, and people were saying, John the Baptist has risen from the dead. Now your versions, all your versions probably that you have on your lap or on your digital device are going to say Baptist, B-A-P-T-I-S-T. However, it's this kind of verb. And it is John the baptizing one. John, who is baptizing. Some versions translate it that way. Well, he's obviously not baptizing. He's dead. But John, this John, is identified by the fact that he was a baptizer. It's identified with an action that is not currently going on. The third passage is Matthew 22. Remember we talked about that one? Told you to remember that text because it's the same kind of phrase as in Titus. If a man dies having no children, let's say the man had three children, but at this time, now, they're all dead. Does his brother have to marry his wife? So, well, no, he had children. No, it doesn't say had. It says having. Said, but what he means is had. I agree. He's a having kind of children man. That having children kind of man, I mean. That's what's in view. So, beware of reading that ing and concluding that at the time he's appointed or 5 years later, 20 years later, he's got to be involved in that action at that time, having faithful children at that time. Well, how do we decide in Titus 1? Well, again, we're looking at not what the man's doing. A man must be doing. No, a man must be. Remember those verbs, to be verbs. We're looking at character. Let's raise this question. Let's suppose this man has three children. Every one of them are Christians. Or if you take the other interpretation of that phrase, every one of these children were respectful and obedient children. But you know they were that, not because of his influence, but because of his wife's influence. He may be a faithful Christian today, but back when his children were at home, for example, he was ungodly, he was a drunkard, he was an infidel. Is that possible? Acts 16 talks about a young man named Timothy. 2 Timothy 1 says it was through the influence of his mother and grandmother. There's no indication his father was a Christian. Very possibly he was a pagan. If Timothy's father later obeyed the gospel, well, he would have at least one, quote, faithful child. Would he be qualified to serve as an elder? See, is it the actual doing of the thing, or are we looking at something about the man? What do the children say about the man? We go back to the law of harmony, and we parallel 1 Timothy in chapter 3, manages his own household well, keeping, that's another present participle, keeping his children in control with all dignity. What if his children are now 35? What if they're 40? Is he still keeping his children in control with all dignity? You say, well, no, he's that kind of man. That's exactly what we're trying to look at as we look at this text. Furthermore, people say, well, and we may have occasion to talk about that some more in our forum tonight. People say, well, if he'd have raised them right, that have stayed, that have obeyed the gospel. We've already dealt with that. Jesus was the master teacher. He did not convert everybody. Same way with Paul. And doesn't the Bible say, train them up in the way they should go, when they're old, they'll not depart from it? If that means you train your children to respect God or respect authority, whichever the case may be, that means when they're 30, they cannot apostatize. They have lost their free moral agency. You don't believe that, do you? Those proverbs are general principles. And so again, we're looking at the qualifications that are in these texts. We're looking at them. There's that Proverbs 22:6. Here's a question that sometimes comes up. What if every one of his children apostatized? Now what? Well, there may be some reason to relook at the situation then, maybe. But what we're trying to do, that would be a judgment thing. We're not so much looking at that statement, having faithful children. And so that's something you'll have to consider. So as we finish our study, we're back to where we began. We want to implement God's plan, not ours. And God's plan that churches have elders, Acts 14. God's plan that each church has its own elders, Titus 1 and 5 as well. And so we don't want, through personal conjecture, to stand in the way of God's plan. Obviously, we don't want to open the gate to unqualified men. So don't take this idea we're just going to take the safe road. Well, the safe road may not be to reject men that are qualified by God's standard. So keep that in mind as you think about the things that we have studied.